This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm David Biancooley, editor of the website TV Worth Watching, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today, the creator of Mad Men, Matthew Weiner.
Have you said it yet?
What?
Have you introduced yourself?
I'm Don Draper from McCann Erickson.
With only two episodes left, Don Draper, who has been concealing his real identity, has just had his professional identity changed against his will. McCann Erickson, a giant advertising company that took over Don's ad agency, Sterling Cooper & Partners, has just absorbed that firm and shut down its offices. The characters we've come to know, at least those of them who survived the layoffs, are being forced to move into McCann's building and play by its rules. These shifts have left all the main characters in crisis. Here's a warning. If you watch the show but aren't caught up, you should know that our interview will have some spoilers about last Sunday's episode. But you're not in danger of finding out how the series ends, because there's no way Matthew Weiner is going to tell us. In addition to creating the series, he's the showrunner, wrote many of the episodes, and directed the remaining two. He also worked on The Sopranos as a writer and producer. Terry spoke with Matthew Weiner last Thursday and began with a scene from a few weeks ago, when Sterling Cooper & Partners was still in its own offices. McCann Erickson had asked the partners at SC&P to write a statement about the company's future. As Don is thinking about the future, Peggy Olson, the head copywriter, walks into his office with a request.
Ted told me I have to fill out my own performance review.
I guess he respects your opinion.
I'm tired of this.
I'd start with that.
I'm serious. I want to have my performance reviewed. I've had quite a year.
What do you see for the future?
Well, is that on there?
No, I'm just curious.
I'd like to be the first woman creative director at this agency. That's funny to you?
No, I'm impressed that you know exactly.
What else is there?
That's what I'm asking. So you get that. What's next?
Land something huge.
And then?
Have a big idea. Create a catchphrase.
So you want fame?
Yes.
What else?
I don't know.
Yes, you do.
Create something of lasting value.
In advertising.
This is supposed to be about my job, not the meaning of life.
So you think those things are unrelated?
I didn't know you'd be in a mood.
Do you want me to do this or not?
Why don't you just write down all of your dreams so I can shit on them?
Matthew Weiner, welcome back to Fresh Air. So it's the end of the series, and Don's looking into the future. He's asking Peggy to look into the future. And he's asking himself, I think, the questions he's asking Peggy, like, what's next? What else? Peggy Lee is singing in the background. Is that all there is? And I'm wondering how you came up with the idea of putting all these kind of bigger questions, all these like existential questions, into Peggy's annual review, her performance evaluation.
That came from the writer's room. There's a bunch of really, really smart people that figure out how to do these stories. What did sort of originate with me is I really wanted to do an episode where you ask this question about the future. I kept thinking, well, what would you want? Let's actually say you have all this. What do you want? And it's sort of been the story of the season. So let's say that you've gotten this mountain of money that these people have received and status and success. And, well, what else is there? And to get Peggy in there, who clearly seems focused at this point on her career, and for Don to say, okay, I see myself in you, but what else is there? And then the scene sort of explains itself. Because I think most people, if you really ask them and you pursue that question, it's going to be disturbing. It's sort of like asking people, what do you enjoy? It's not that clear for people. And that question is a big part of the end of the show. It's we're sort of channeling where we are on some level, assuming that we've had some success, but also what's going on with the characters.
I've gone back and watched some of the episodes of the first season, and I'm just kind of amazed at how you're kind of connecting things from the first season to what's happening now. And I just want to play an example of that. And this is from season one, episode seven, when Jim Hobart of McCann Erickson, like the big corporate advertising company that recently bought Don Draper's advertising company, Sterling Cooper. So this is back in season one. Jim Hobart of McCann is trying to woo Don to leave Sterling Cooper and join McCann. But Don decides to stay at Sterling Cooper. Then he goes into Roger's office to tell him and to negotiate the terms of his staying. Roger offers him a raise. Don doesn't want a contract. Don hates to be tied down to anything. And so we'll pick it up in that scene with Roger talking.
I'm not going to be a little girl and ask you why you stayed. I know it's not money. And I hope it's not to keep your foot on Pete Campbell.
I like the way you do business.
Well, I try to be as civilized as you can be.
No contract.
45 and no security. Well, what's in it for me?
If I leave this place one day, it will not be for more advertising.
What else is there?
I don't know, life being lived. I'd like to stop talking about it and get back to it.
I've worked with a lot of men like you, and if you had to choose a place to die, it would be in the middle of a pitch.
I've done that. I want to do something else.
Okay, that's John Hamm and John Slattery in a scene from the first season of Mad Men. And it's just amazing to me, like, in that scene you have Roger asking Don the kind of questions Don asked Peggy in this season, like,
yes.
What else? What else is there? Like, what do you really want? And you also have Don, in a way, suggesting what the end of the series might be, because Don says, if I leave this company, it's not going to be for more advertising. He's basically just told us he'd never go to McCann. So what were you thinking when you wrote that scene, you know, in the very first season?
I was literally wondering what was holding him there. I mean, the character has a certain integrity that you can't really argue with. I'm not saying that he's a person with integrity. I mean that he has the substance that is that person. And you try to be true to that. But I remember thinking, this is a hard thing to negotiate. This is a hard thing to figure out. I know that this man doesn't want his name on the building at that point because he's afraid of being revealed. I know that he's not motivated by money. I know that he has a fantasy of the kind of person he wants to be and the life that he wanted. And at the same time, I think that we all live with this ambiguous relationship with our work where we know on some level that it's not life, or we don't really, or maybe I didn't even understand at that time. I mean, I remember having an argument in the writer's room about why he was staying and what was making him stay there. And somebody said to me, well, he and Roger are friends. That's going to help. And I was like, they are? Oh, yeah. I mean, I just met Roger. I don't know. And this is a really, I mean, my answers are always long. I apologize for that. But I think that's who that man is. And we've just tried to hold it in there. And I have a hard time answering those questions myself. Don't you? I mean, you've been doing this a long time.
What else is there?
What else is there? And it's not such a negative question. This is called contemplation, and it can be destructive to people because it can make them feel unsatisfied with what they have, but it also is something you hear about sabbaticals and things like that. It is worth taking an inventory once in a while if you're serious about, especially if you had goals and dreams and achieved some of them, if you're lucky enough. It's something to reevaluate, and Don is a thinking person, and we've tried to treat all the characters in the show that sometimes they ignore these questions and sometimes they just go on with them. I mean, what does Roger want? I mean, I've had to ask that a million times.
So
the guy's super rich. He's like, you know what I mean? Why is he working?
I want to ask you about something about Peggy, because I think so many of us are rooting for her.
Sure. Me too.
So when you created her as a secretary, what future did you see for her then?
Well, in the pilot, she is, you know, the other story in the pilot, which is her first day, and she's going to be taken around by what I consider to be the keeper of the harem, Joan, the queen of the courtesans, and be told how it works. And we will see, is she naive? We'll see how smart she is by how she handles this. She reacts immediately by making a pass at Don. But the whole premise of the show that I had from when I wrote the pilot, and you have to understand, there are 7 years between when I wrote the pilot and when I wrote the second episode of the show. So I did have time to think about it. But I didn't think when I was writing it, okay, this woman is going to ascend in some way. How will she ascend? Well, it has to be at Don's bidding, and Don does give her a promotion at the end of the first season. But I always imagined her being discovered. She doesn't have an Ivy League education, which is limiting to a lot of people going near advertising. Forget about women in general. And women were utilized as a kind of idea factory. They were not paid for it. They would have these brainstorming sessions, and I knew that I wanted to do that the first season and that Peggy would shine and that they would recognize it, that it would be some sort of merit-based promotion or recognition, but it would still have what Freddie Rumsen says. It's still like watching a dog play the piano. He was surprised that she had that kind of insight. And it also was an education for the audience about what talent in advertising was about. Because we've tried to be very honest about the creative process and show a lot of mistakes being made, a lot of wrong roads being taken down, a lot of pitches that fail because the client's not up to it or because the person's not prepared or whatever, a lot of moments of inspiration, which I'm very interested in, you know, as much as drama will tolerate someone thinking. I love the idea that Peggy knew a basket of kisses, that she knew that that was a poetic representation of the product, that she just instinctively was on top of it.
So this is a question about casting for the character Joan.
Sure.
Was this
Joan? Yeah, I didn't know Joan was going to be a main character. I can just say that right now.
But here's the question: did you know that Joan had to have very large breasts, and that would be an example of how she was stereotyped because of the shape of her body and how men responded to it?
No, I did not. Joan, to me, in my mind when I was writing the pilot, was more like an Eve Arden type. Like, I thought she was very pointy.
Yeah, Eve Arden was always like the best friend, the tough-talking
best
friend.
The best friend, yes, but tough-talking and, sarcastic, realistic, and not like the best friends now who are always like, God, I can't believe he did that to you. A best friend with an attitude of like, you're so dumb. Everyone knows how this works but you. That is a character point of view from that office dynamic that's almost a cliche. When Christina Hendricks came in and read for it, I just thought, first of all, she's so beautiful and so poised and conveys such confidence that I just thought, this is someone who, if they were a man, would be running the world. Well, guess what? Maybe she is running the world. Maybe she's doing it in the traditional, you know, Greek tragedy way, you know, or Lady Macbeth way. She's behind the scenes. She's grabbing power the way only a woman can. But her sexual confidence and her demand to be taken seriously and to not suffer any insolence or anything, her power was immediately apparent in the audition. It had nothing to do with her physique, quite honestly, and it never has. I was kind of shocked by the reaction to her physique, other than the fact that actresses and actors too, John Hamm as well, they are frequently symbols of beauty. We don't pick average people to do that, and they become sex symbols, and I could tell that she was a huge sex symbol. I could see that. But I picked her because I cast for performance and for voice, and the idea of her and Peggy walking down the hall together felt to me like that's the story of the show. Two different women with two different sets of skills, ambitions, etc.
And bodies.
Two totally different bodies. And by the way, having different bodies on the show, that was like part of my goal. I'm like, I asked the actresses to stop working out their upper bodies. Everything that sort of depicts physical health and physical attention without clothing is part of the aesthetic right now, of the silhouette, if you will. But I wanted them to be a little bit softer, a little bit fuller, to be their natural selves. I mean, actresses, as a rule, are all way skinnier than the rest of us can handle being in lives. Mm-hmm. And that's part of their job also. Actors, too, just being on camera, they make their living from their physical presence. But, I was surprised that no one else had used her this way in her career. And I was surprised also at the reaction to, like, well, that's a real woman. There was sort of an insinuation that she was fat, and wasn't it great to see a fat person on TV playing someone sexy? And I just kept saying, like, I don't know what world you're in, but this woman is, like, one of the most exceptionally beautiful people that you're ever going to run across. And the fact that TV or the society didn't see that as a standard at that moment was shocking to me.
Did you go back and rewatch the first season, or did you feel like you knew it so well you didn't need to rewatch anything to know exactly what language was used, to know exactly what plot points you wanted to pick up on?
I tried before we started the last 14 episodes. That was, you know, we shot them all at once, even though they've been spread out over 2 years. I went back and I said, I'm going to watch the entire series up to this point to prepare myself for writing these last 14 episodes. I did not make it through the entire thing because I ran out of time, and it is quite a commitment to do that.
What surprised you about what you saw that you'd maybe forgotten, where you thought, like, wow, that was interesting, I need to pick up on that? Did that happen?
It totally happened, yeah. It's happened quite a bit, actually. Sometimes the characters, the actors remind you of it also. But, you know, Don's love for Betty, and in their good times, he's older than her, and I forgot that, if that makes sense. He's appropriate for marriages at that time, but it's like, you know, 10 years. And I remembered the sort of idyllic nature of their family life being baloney, because it has now become rosier to me too as I've passed from it. And I think remembering the dynamics, trying not to repeat the dynamics that I saw, it was more about cautionary thing, like, don't go there again. We did have a meeting in the writer's room. When we opened the writer's room for the last thing, I said, is there a story that we've always wanted to tell that we haven't told? And it could be something that I brought up or anything like that. We had a list on the wall. Is there anything like that that we always wanted to do in the show? And a bunch of stuff ended up in the show.
Give me one example.
It was one of my stories that the writers had been urging me to put in, and I had always resisted it because I think it didn't make any sense. But it's the story with Betty taking Bobby on the field trip, and that was and him eating her lunch.
I was like, she's so angry about it.
Yeah, when he says, "I wish it was yesterday," that was actually turned out to be a pretty resonant part of the show. But I was like, "That's just a bad story about my childhood."
What, you ate your mother's lunch and she was angry with you?
Yeah. Yeah, and she came on the field trip. She didn't really participate in school that much, and I was so in love with her and so excited that she had come along, and then I kind of ruined it because I ate one of the sandwiches and gave one away, traded it for gumdrops, and I'd never seen her eat. So it was kind of shocking to me that she had brought lunch for her, but it was irreversible and something that I would wake up and be, crying about for years, you know, just like, oh, why did I do that? Why did I give her sandwich away? It's funny because it makes her sound bad in a way, and I'm aware of that, but I actually feel like what stories like this show is that maybe it's the combination of a slightly insensitive parent and an incredibly oversensitive child. So we both bear culpability in it, but that was a story that I was like, nobody gives a crap about that. Why are we doing that? And I had told that like the first week of the first season, and it was in the notes.
Wow. So was your mother dieting like Betty was? Like, you know, her son maybe didn't see her eat because she tried not to.
Yes, always. My mother was always dieting, and sometimes she failed, and she had put on weight at a certain point like Betty did, and then now she's the skinniest person in the entire world.
Right.
There is no alcoholism in my home, despite you seeing it on the show. It was all of the dysfunction is related to food.
I have another plot question to ask you.
Sure.
And this is another example of the current season echoing or connecting with the very early episodes. The final half of the final season started with Don talking to a beautiful woman who's wearing underwear and a fur coat. And he's telling her how to look even more sexy with it. And we don't really know, are they about to make love or what's going on? And soon the camera pulls back and we realize he's shooting an ad with her and he's trying to coach her and how she should look. I guess it's more like an audition. But
it is an audition, yes.
Yeah. Anyways.
But it comes off as like an S&M mild S&M situation to begin with, where he's sort of ordering her around, which we have seen him do with
women. Which you and I have talked about.
Yes.
Talked about that theme in Don's life, wanting to be slapped by a prostitute. Yeah, and the carpet
who's the
clean
S and
clean
who's the M
with,
changes.
Yes, right. No, exactly. Exactly. But anyway, so like this fur coat thing is like, why are we seeing the fur coat thing? And then he has a dream that Rachel, the heiress to the department store who's in the first season, she appears to him in a dream wearing a fur coat. And so when I was rewatching part of the first season, I was reminded of something that I'd forgotten over the years, which is that Don and Betty, his first wife, met when he was working for a fur company and she was modeling furs. And
you want to know what the significance of the fur is? Well, first of all, my grandfather, my mother's father, worked at a place called Manhattan Fleischer's, which was a fur dressing company, and they did fur. They were in the fur business in Russia.
Wow.
And I grew up with a lot of fur in my house, and it was not my grandfather used to watch the nature shows with us when he lived with us, and he would, for all the wrong reasons, be like, oh, yeah, Hudson seal. It was a beautiful animal. I must have handled 40,000 of those. Like, Grandpa, that's an endangered animal. And he would pet people's dogs, and you'd see him, like, rubbing the fur the wrong way on the dog. He was an expert on that. And it was a big part of the period. And Janie and I, my costume designer, we both love that. So I felt that Don worked in a fur company because I love the fur business, and that it's something that's completely politically incorrect now and was a gigantic business and was something that you would give one fur to your wife and another to your mistress. It was literally like buying someone a home. So it is the ultimate symbol of luxury. And they're doing an ad for Wilkinson razors, and there is nothing to convey smoothness better than naked skin with fur on it. It's a, you know, that's the cliche world that they're working in. Call it fetishism, but that's what it is. But it is earned fetishism because it is part of our family business. Ironically, my other grandfather, my father's father, was in the shoe business. So you will see a lot of, or footwear, as it's called. So
oh, yes, right, because Joni corrects somebody about, he says oh, shoes, yeah, and she says, no, it's footwear. Yeah.
They do not like it to be called shoes.
Why?
Because shoes sound like something you put on a horse, and it's kind of crude, and it doesn't have the elegance of footwear. And footwear is all-encompassing. It's boots, it's sandals, it's socks sometimes, hosiery, you never know, but it's shoes.
Did you grow up with antique furs? Do you still have it?
Yes. My parents have a fur closet with all the inherited furs. And I actually, there's a Sopranos episode where a woman buys a fur coat that I wrote. yeah, I know the difference between fox and chinchilla and, you know, and and sable and a Persian lamb and all those different things. So seal. It's a terrible thing, but they did, in fairness, they did come from Russia. It was really cold. It wasn't just about killing animals.
Well, I guess what I want to say is thank you for so many hours of really pleasurable, thoughtful, reflective, sometimes funny viewing. It's been so great to watch Mad Men. I look forward to the final two episodes, and I'm really grateful to you for those shows.
I hope to come back and talk about something new.
Deal.
Matthew Weiner is the creator and showrunner of Mad Men. The crime novelist Ted Lewis, who died in 1982, has long been well known in his native Britain for writing the book that became the movie Get Carter. He's been less known in America, except among buffs and other writers. But in recent months, Soho Press has begun releasing his major works. The latest to appear is his final novel, GBH, which has never before been published in the U.S. Our critic at large, John Powers, says it's proof that Ted Lewis deserves his corner in the crime writing world.
In his famous essay, The Simple Art of Murder, Raymond Chandler put down the classic British mystery, making fun of its arcane killings and hokey air of gentility. He preferred the tough American style, and praised Dashiell Hammett for, as he put it, taking murder out of the vicar's rose garden and dropping it in the alley where it belonged. The man who did the same for British mysteries was Ted Lewis. Between 1965 and 1980, Lewis wrote 9 novels whose gritty, propulsive storytelling would influence writers on both sides of the Atlantic. The best known of these is Get Carter, one of 3 novels about a gangster named Jack Carter. This tremendous book got turned into one of the greatest crime movies ever, with Michael Caine in the lead. 10 years later, Lewis wrote his final novel, GBH. The initials stand for Grievous Bodily Harm, and many fans think it's even better. The book is now available from Soho Press, and it's a pulp fiction triumph worthy of Jim Thompson or James Ellroy. I can't remember the last time I turned pages so eagerly. GBH is narrated by a London gangster, George Fowler, whose business in rough, exceedingly illegal blue movies has made him rich, powerful, and dangerous. He's got a posh lawyer, cops on his payroll, a trusty goon of a sidekick named Mickey, and a gorgeous, sexed-up wife, Jean, who's every bit as kinky as he is. George has everything a bloke could want, until he spots a loose thread in his seamlessly smooth operation. When he pulls it, his whole world starts to unravel. That's the simple version anyway, but Lewis doesn't tell this story simply. Instead, he deftly intercuts 2 time frames. One is set in the present, in the off-season resort of Mablethorpe, where George keeps a seaside hideout and finds himself getting involved with Leslie, a blonde who may really be a brunette, or a brunette who may really be a blonde. The other storyline takes place in London, nicknamed The Smoke, and chronicles what happened with his wife, lawyer, and sidekick that forced George to hide out in Mablethorpe. As we hopscotch between present and past, the sea and the smoke, we gradually discover that George is so mired in events that he doesn't fully grasp his own story. The same may have been true of Lewis, a self-destructive sort who died at 42. He was a boozer, a womanizer, and I've heard it said, not immune to participating in dodgy enterprises. True or not, his sense of the criminal life is utterly convincing. You won't find any debonair cat burglars in his world. He knows the appetites that drive violent men, knows the codes of honor that give the underworld a kind of morality, and knows how the British ruling class has its finger in every pie, even the illegal ones. Not one to glamorize criminals, Lewis is brilliant at showing us the seedy world they inhabit. Get Carter is one of the best ever fictional portraits of a small industrial English city, with its tawdry shops, dingy rooming houses, and suffocating air of decline from something that wasn't that great to begin with. It's matched by the disillusioned pungency of GBH's vision of off-season Mablethorpe, with its talent-challenged cabaret, shuttered amusement park, and gigantic hotel bar that George describes as having all the charm of a crematorium. Lewis really knows and feels the places he's writing about. And his work cuts to the bone, both literally and metaphysically. At his best, he achieves something that only a handful of crime writers ever do, the chilling sense of cosmic fatality that links noir anti-heroes to the likes of Oedipus and Macbeth. Now, it might be a tad much to call GBH a tragedy. George lacks the requisite nobility of soul. He's a thuggish porn baron, after all. But his story is one of hubris, and it leads him to an inexorable fall. The cocky George is a clever, masterful man who learns, too late, of course, that he's not quite as clever and masterful as he thought.
John Powers is film and TV critic for Vogue and Vogue.com. He reviewed Ted Lewis's 1980 novel, GBH. Coming up, St. Louis Cardinals manager Mike Matheny tells us about coaching youth baseball, his 13 years as a big league catcher, and taking a pitch in the jaw. This is Fresh Air Weekend. Imagine you're in a stressful situation, trying to do something really difficult, and a bunch of your friends and family are watching, screaming at the top of their lungs while you're trying to do it. Our next guest, Mike Matheny, says that's exactly what parents do to their kids all the time in youth sports. Matheny is a former big league catcher who spent 13 years in the majors, winning 4 Gold Glove Awards. He's now the manager of the St. Louis Cardinals. But he's almost as well known for a code of behavior he wrote after he retired from the big leagues and agreed to coach his son's youth baseball team. The rules were for the parents, who, Matheny says, are the biggest problem in youth sports. Matheny's new book is The Matheny Manifesto, A Young Manager's Views on Success in Sports and Life. He spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies last Monday.
Well, Mike Matheny, welcome to Fresh Air. In 2008, you left the game, finally, after some concussions, and were asked to coach a youth baseball team while your 10-year-old kid was going to be on it. And you're right that before you did it, you really did some thinking about what kind of a program you wanted to run, and wrote this long letter to parents. And it begins with you saying that the biggest problem in youth sports is the parents. How do you want parents to behave at a game? What do you tell them?
Well, we went overboard. And we asked the parents not to do anything. It was almost a trial run. And I knew it was going to be a stretch because, you know, a lot of the time your social structure is kind of revolved around what's going on with your kids in their sports. And it becomes your social group. And almost at times part of the problem is it defines you and who you are by how well your kids play in youth sports. And so we just asked the parents to step away from that and really just be a silent source of encouragement. And we would give them some things to work on because it's very, very important what they're doing at home and just playing some catch and going out and having a good time. We encouraged them to take their kids to go get some ice cream after a game, even when we lost. But mostly during the game, do whatever you could just to take yourself out of the picture. The kids don't necessarily need you to be yelling words of encouragement at the top of your lungs. And this is really coming from a number of studies where they go and they interview collegiate, high school, and even lower level athletes and asking them, what do you want your parents to do at the game? And the overwhelming answer is absolutely nothing. And it comes back to what's the goal. This is about the kid. It's not about the parents.
And when your parent is shouting the encouraging thing like, come on, Johnny, you can do it, you're saying that actually they got enough pressure that they put on themselves.
Well, just think about it, you know, you had a group of people that you care about most, and you're getting ready to go make a big presentation for work, and someone's yelling, you know, at the top of their lungs, you can do this, you can do this, you can do this, and all of a sudden it doesn't work out, and you feel like you let everybody down. You know, these kids put so much pressure, and this stuff's tough, and whether it is learning an instrument or it's playing a sport, trying to get that right and do it perfectly to everybody's expectations is tough. And I'll take the game of baseball. You know, hitting that round ball with a round bat and doing that consistently, you're going to fail 70% of the time, even the best players do. And in the meanwhile, you're trying to please your teammates. You're trying to please your coach. And then you got the most important person in your world back there screaming at you. And you think, if I don't get this done, I disappoint them. And that's when you get to the point where these kids just check out and they say, listen, I just can't get this thing right. I might as well go back to my room and play some video games where nobody bothers me.
I like your description of some of the things you did with the kids. I mean, particularly in the early part of the season, you say you want to get to the point where you're winning, but you're really teaching them. Talk about some of the things you did with positions and lineup in the early weeks of the season.
Yeah, and this really does apply to kids that are just learning the game. And I think it's how you define success and what were your goals. And our success and goals revolved around whether these kids wanted to show up to the next practice, whether these kids wanted to show up to the next game, and at the end of the season, whether they wanted to play the game again. And that's how we defined what our success would be. And in the meanwhile, we're going to teach them a passion for the game. And I think you can only do that by exposing them to every part of the game. And we went in with a 20-year plan in mind that these are some kids that we're going to be committed to. And some are going to be really good at this game, some not so much, but that's not our aim. Our aim is to be mentors, to be guides, and to be resources and references for them to the point where I am right now with a lot of these boys. I'm writing and calling college coaches and just admission boards and talking about these boys as people and not just baseball players. But at the time, I needed to earn their confidence. I needed to get them to understand that this is an extracurricular activity that should be fun. And so to do that, we put them all over the field. I let left-handers catch if they wanted to catch. I put a left-hander at shortstop. I put a kid that had trouble ever throwing the ball anywhere near the plate. I threw him on the mound and just to see if they had fun with it and then to challenge them and then give them some work. And that's where parents really came in. And we would give the parents and the young man some homework. They needed to go home and they needed to play catch and they needed to throw so many pitches and the parent needed to flip some wiffle balls to the boy and try and get in so many swings and then see what kind of commitment level they had and match that together with their talents and then to see how far they could take it, because we're not shy about trying to get these kids to play as far as they can, but that's not the ultimate goal. The ultimate goal was to invest into them as people.
It was 2012, I guess, that you were picked to manage the St. Louis Cardinals, then the defending World Series champion, right?
Correct. It was right after the 2011 season.
Okay. All right. Taking the place of a legendary figure in baseball, Tony La Russa, you had had no professional managing experience. Do you think that the letter to Little League parents, which had gotten some attention by then, do you think that helped you get the job?
You know, I actually talked to our general manager, and he had seen the letter online. It kind of went viral, especially in St. Louis. And he was aware of it. So I can't say that it didn't impact the way he thought in some way.
Right. You bring an approach to managing that you call servant leadership. When I think of a big league manager, I don't think of a servant. I think of a guy with his arms folded and this steely look in his eyes as he surveys his team in the field, being firm, decisive, sometimes loud, maybe even abusive. How does this work in baseball?
Well, I try to stay away from the abusive part, but the rest of it's true. I mean, but that's only a small portion of my job description. The real impact that I'm able to have, and anybody on our club, especially our staff, is able to have is the in-between time, and that's in the clubhouse. That's when we're traveling on the road. That's when we're in our practices. It's our workouts before the game, and those are the opportunities for guys to find out whether this is about me or whether it's about them. And for me, to see the greatest impacts that people have had on my life is when they've invested into me. And if I know they care, they're going to get something extra out of me. And I truly believe in the old saying that nobody cares what you have to say until they know that you care. And I've seen that work, and I've seen the opposite also. So that's an atmosphere that we've tried to create on our staff. We're not going to pull rank. We're going to figure out how to make people better by serving them better. And that kind of sounds fuzzy. And kind of warm, and it's not anything except getting outside of yourself and your own intentions and your own ambitions and trying to make it about somebody else.
Now, you spent, 13 years as a catcher in the big leagues, if I have that right?
That's right.
Okay. Now, that means that one of the big decisions a manager has to make is when to pull a pitcher. And so hundreds of times when you were a catcher, you would go out to the mound and hear these conversations when the manager comes out, talks to the pitcher, and asks him to give up the ball so he can bring in somebody in from the bullpen. I wonder, over the years, as you saw those conversations, did you think, you know what, this is how I would do it? Did you see people, managers, making mistakes in communication that you felt like you wouldn't make or you'd want to do differently?
You know, Dave, the majority of the time, those decisions are made before that manager ever gets out there. And there are other times it can be a reconnaissance mission where you go out and you can see just how badly this guy wants to stay in the game. You can look in their eye a little bit and see if they've got it or not, or if they're looking for a life preserver. And I think each manager I had, I always enjoyed getting out there before he got there just so I could see the whole thing go into play and see, is he really testing this pitcher right now, or has he already made up his mind? Is he just stalling? And I think that's why a lot of times you see catchers transition into this manager position a little more seamlessly, because there's so many different things that go into the thought process of a catcher besides just my space right now, my responsibility. Catcher has to have his hands kind of on a lot of different things.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Now, I recognize that. Even if the manager has made the decision when he gets to the mound, and it's often made because the manager usually doesn't come out to the mound unless there's a decision made to change pitchers, how you communicate with the pitcher probably matters, doesn't it?
Yeah, I think so. And, you know, some people take a lot of pride in how they do communicate. And, you know, there was another era, too, that was just old school and rough and gruff. And the only communication was a couple grunts. And there were some heated conversations out there, too, just two guys flat yelling at each other right there on national TV. And those were always entertaining. But, you know, I did know that, you know, there was normally negative repercussions that came down the line once that interaction did happen. But for the most part, there was never a whole lot. Usually your veteran ace Your guy that's been around a long time, he'd have a little more say. The rest of the guys, they're really kind of at the mercy of whatever the pitching coach or the manager thought at the time, and whatever communication was typically pretty short.
Arguing with umpires is part of a manager's job. What's your approach to that?
You know, this video review's kind of taken that art away, and not that I was ever very good at it because I hadn't been around this gig very long, but with the opportunity to go to replay at the big league level, there really isn't much of it. You kind of go out and you have an awkward conversation with an umpire that you're kind of frustrated with, that you have to be out there anyhow because you thought he missed the call. But in the meanwhile, instead of getting all angry, you're kind of asking him if he wants a cup of tea and how his family's doing while we're waiting for the video process to go through. But there is still a little bit of an art of that between the managers and the home plate umpire, trying to get the kind of strike zone that you want. So it happens every night, and we're trying to manipulate to get better pitches called and making sure that we're being treated fairly.
And are there times you want to get ejected?
Well, yeah, that happens. Typically, it's when I know my team needs to see me stand up for them, and they just got to know that I'll fight for them. And most of the time, they're being wronged by an umpire in their mind. And when our team has been beaten down a little bit, and you can tell that our morale's down, because through 162 games, you're going to have those stretches where things just aren't quite right. And they need to see some life. And a lot of times, unfortunately, it's the interaction between an umpire and the manager.
Now, one of the things that happens in big league baseball is there are times when it's considered acceptable for a pitcher to deliberately throw at and hit another batter. Maybe when one of your teammates has been hit by the opposing pitcher, maybe when a batter has sort of violated the rules of etiquette by showing up your pitcher, or, you know, strutting around the bases after a home run. And one thing that occurred to me as I read about these things is, you know, I know that you felt that retaliation is never acceptable in youth ball. And you're right about a couple of cases in the book that just should not happen in youth baseball. Why is it okay among grown-ups to do that, to hit somebody in response to something happening in the game?
Oh, boy. This is a tough topic. And, you know, I do have my own personal beliefs on where I stand. It is against the rules. It's very clear. And it comes back also to the conversation we just had about being able to stand up for your players and making sure that they're being protected. And this is on the physical side. But I'm glad you started with this not being something that's acceptable at the youth level. I just truly don't believe. And why do I think it's acceptable in one place and not the other? And I think one comes down to it's our livelihood. And we're talking about the health, potentially lives. And so we have to make sure that we're very careful, you know, not to have anything happen to where somebody's throwing it at somebody else's head. And, I mean, some bad things can happen there. But there are also, I believe there's rules within the rules of the game. If we were having this conversation after something just happened, I'd just be telling you that, yeah, we like to pitch inside. Sometimes it gets away. But there's other times when somebody takes too many liberties, and we got to make sure that they're uncomfortable with a pitch inside to make sure that our guys are protected. That's a fine line to be walking. It's not something that I have a great answer for you, because it is very hypocritical when you start saying that it shouldn't happen at the youth level, but we can allow it at the big league level. But once people's livelihoods are at stake, and once again, my job description is figuring out how to defend my guys the best that I can.
Yeah, you know, I know that's the explanation that people give. I had to protect my guys. But when I think it through, I think, well, does that really make it any less likely that your guys are going to get hurt if you whack their shortstop in the back? Does it, do you think?
It does stop nonsense. And if people are just freely throwing up and in on a player or on a team and they feel that there's no negative repercussions, the only way to get it to stop is sometimes do the same thing, and then the umpires will step in. And then you're talking about ejections, you're talking about suspensions. If the umpires don't step in, and they oftentimes do a very good job of starting to smell when something like that's coming along, and they'll jump in. But if it's not, and our guys continue to be targets, yeah, it actually does start to slow down the impact that could have.
You had a horrible experience as a hitter, 1998, when you were with the Brewers playing the Pirates. Rich Loisel, is that who the pitcher was?
That's right.
And tell us what happened.
The backstory to this is I was really struggling hitting, like I was the majority of my career, And I'd made an agreement with my manager that every time I struck out on a breaking ball, I owed him a sleeve of golf balls. And I ended up probably buying that man a truck full of golf balls. But I was determined to stay in there. I wasn't seeing the breaking ball well. I never really did.
Stay in there, meaning not flinch back when the ball's coming at you and it might break over the plate.
Correct. Because most breaking balls, if they're going to be a pitch that you can hit as a curveball, it's going to start at you for the most part. And so just staying in there is not flinching and being prepared if it does break over the plate that you can still swing. And so it was in the late innings. I believe we were down a runner tied, and I knew I needed to stay in there. This guy threw really hard, but he also had a good breaking ball, and I had a breaking ball weakness. So as I was staying in there and I thought this ball was going to break, it didn't, and it hit me square in the jaw. It was amazing how much I bled. I was very fortunate, though. It hit me in a really good spot. A little bit higher, it would have hit my orbital bone. A little lower, it would have probably broken my jaw. Fortunately, it just broke some teeth, and they pulled me out of the game because I couldn't stop bleeding, and got stitched up and was actually able to play the next night.
You're leaving out a part of the story. What did you do when you got hit?
Well, the reason people bring this story up a lot is because I just kind of stood there, and I don't have an answer. I have no idea why. I had a mixture of emotions. I was concerned because I was bleeding so much, and I was mad. I never liked to get hit. I knew it wasn't intentional at that particular point of the game, but it didn't make any difference. I was mad nonetheless. And then I was confused of whether I should start getting off the field or am I going to pass out from lack of blood. So I just kind of stood there and I looked at the pitcher and, the teeth and the blood and that sort of stuff kind of did what it did and made my way off the field.
Yeah, well, I've seen the video of it. And, you can see the umpire and the catcher immediately jump up and start waving for the trainers. And you kind of look there for a minute as if you were waiting for a bus and then spit a pint of blood onto the field. It's pretty dramatic. Well, Mike Matheny, there are a lot of National League fans that would not want me to wish you a good season. But I'm going to say I've enjoyed it. Thanks a lot, and have a great year with the Cardinals.
Dave, thank you very much.
Mike Matheny spoke with Fresh Air contributor Dave Davies last Monday. Matheny's new book is called The Matheny Manifesto. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Sheehan. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shurrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Our administrative assistant is Dorothy Farabee. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancooley.